Welcome to episode 16 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. We are lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. Thank you for joining us. Today's lineup includes Jason Weinstein, formerly with the Justice Department, where he oversaw criminal computer crime prosecutions, among other things. He's now doing criminal and civil litigation at Steptoe. Michael Vadas, formerly of the FBI and the Justice Department, now in Steptoe's New York office, and just back from a tour of the Johnstown Flood Museum. How was that, Michael?
Unfortunately, the Flood Museum was closed, but I did get to ride the vehicular plane, which is the longest and steepest of its type in the world. Do you know what a vehicular plane is?
No.
It's basically a flat elevator that goes up a rail up the side of a mountain, really steep mountain, from flood happens all the way up to the top where people were not flooded.
So like a cog railway.
Yeah, but it could take horse-drawn carriages or later motor cars. Pretty cool.
Very nice. Plus, all that time in the minivan with the children. That's great. we did miss you. We did miss you. Chris Conti, formerly with the SEC, has returned to Steptoe and Johnson. We'll be here to talk about some SEC developments. And our guest for the day is Alex Joel, the Civil Liberties Protection Officer of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you.
I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and DHS, holding the record for returning to Steptoe & Johnson the most number of times from government. Let's get started. We're traditionally doing This Week in NSA for as long as that remains the top of the news. Remarkably, there's not a lot of legal developments, and it was a pretty good week for NSA, or at least a bad week for people who hate NSA. Edward Snowden went on national TV in Russia to ask Vladimir Putin, do you do any of that mass surveillance stuff? And Putin said no, for a variety of reasons. We're legal, subject to all these legal controls, plus we can't afford it. Almost universally, people said, what is Edward Snowden doing serving up softball questions like that to Vladimir Putin on Putin's propaganda show? And it certainly did look that way. He went to The Guardian the next day and wrote an op-ed saying, are you kidding? I was really criticizing him. I was asking the same question that Senator Wyden asked of Jim Clapper. I was actually raising questions about the Russian government's use of surveillance tools. There were a lot of defenders of Snowden who went on and say, see, he's actually criticizing the president of Russia. I thought, if he really believed that was criticism, he's a fool. And if he didn't, then he was just being Putin's tool. This was a real loss of moral elevation for him to do this. And since inevitably, the NSA scandal is being personalized as Jim Clapper versus Edward Snowden. It was a bad week for Edward Snowden.
Dude, I hear Putin came out this morning and said that his answer was the least untruthful that he could think of.
We're going to let Alex talk about that in the least untruthful way he can. Yes, I'm sure that we can expect that. Putin does have a sense of humor, especially when he's being snarky about the United States, so I wouldn't be surprised if he had said that. The other development that I thought was also good for NSA in a sort of negative way was the Bloomberg story claiming that NSA was exploiting Heartbleed, the notorious bug discovered in OpenSSL after 2 years hiding in plain sight. That Bloomberg story has sunk like a stone. Bloomberg continues to write stories suggesting that the sources are standing by it, but they're explaining that maybe they would just meant that there were ways to exploit SSL that NSA had used, and Bloomberg is changing the the topic to, well, we just thought it was important to talk about all these zero days that were being stored by NSA, and no one else is picking up on this story because it's not particularly credible. And again, I think that may signal that the days when you could just say anything about NSA and everybody would believe it are slowly coming to an end. And while Alex is here, I should compliment him on the fact that the denial came out in cycle within 5 or 6 hours of the story running. The DNI and NSA had said, no, this is just not true. And those flat denials actually turned out to be pretty credible and got a fair amount of coverage and probably stopped a horde of people from jumping on the story and repeating it.
Yeah, I certainly don't take any personal credit for that, but I think it is a dramatic indication of how forward-leaning we've become on transparency issues. For an intelligence service to come out so quickly and issue that kind of unequivocal statement about something that really relates to potential core intelligence activities, as you know, Stuart, is really almost unprecedented. And I think that's the world we live in right now, and we're going to have to do more of that going forward. But it's a very hard thing for intelligence services to do.
Yeah, it's costly, the sort of activities that would lead to using a vulnerability like that can be very decentralized. I mean, I recognize NSA is a surprisingly centralized place compared to FBI or CIA, but checking everywhere, which I'm sure they wanted to do in that amount of time, is really pretty difficult.
I think there are all kinds of difficulties, but just from a classified information perspective, for us to set a precedent that we're going to come out on a very specific matter like this and issue a statement, you know, what does that mean for the next time something comes up and the time after that? I mean, are we going to be caught in a cycle of having to issue statements with respect to every single allegation that comes out? Obviously not. But that is the kind of concern that comes up when we're dealing with transparency and the need to keep sources and methods secrets, because people can ask a range of questions or make a range of allegations and then make determinations as to what is actually going on based on what elicits a response versus what doesn't.
Right. I'm sure Vladimir Putin is about to announce that he believes that his personal phone is being tapped by NSA. And I don't expect you to deny that. Moving on. We've talked a few times about magistrates who are enthusiastic about expanding their authority over search warrants. Boy, that's a trend that continues. And a magistrate here in D.C. has just invited amicus participation on his unreviewable discretion to approve or deny a search warrant. Jason, did you follow this?
Yeah, this is the same magistrate we spoke about last week who, over the course of a 2-month period, rejected 11 search warrants for computers or email accounts, and it appears that his 50 minutes are not up yet. So this is magistrate Judge John Facciola here in the District of Columbia. And we talked last week about a split among magistrates on whether the standard for getting prospective cell site location information is probable cause, the same standard you need for a search warrant, or whether it's what a statute defines as specific and articulable facts. There's been less of a dispute historically over the question of historical cell tower information. So prospective would be what cell towers your phone's going to be hanging off of over the next 30 days when you make calls, and historical is, you know, what cell towers your phone was hitting off of during a call 6 weeks ago. The standard for historical, it's generally been accepted that it's specific and articulable facts. And the warrant issue, whether a warrant's required, has really been, the focus has been on whether you need it for perspective. But in a case involving historical cell site information, Magistrate Facciola has taken the extraordinary step of asking for briefing from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a civil liberties group, and for factual development on the way cell phones work. And in doing so, has taken a fairly routine law enforcement request and turned it into anything but a routine proceeding, said he can't resolve the question of what the standard should be and how the Fourth Amendment applies without taking evidence about what subscribers understand about how their phones are tracked. Interestingly, in the very same week that this ruling was coming down, Justice John Paul Stevens was giving a speech in Atlanta in which he made remarks about the application of the Fourth Amendment to cell phones, and he compared cell phone metadata to license plate information, you know, saying that there was some degree of privacy intrusion involved when the government gets your phone metadata, but that it was commonplace and limited in scope and was in some ways the price society pays for the advances in technology that cell phones represent. So I think the contrast of those
two. You're forgetting something key, which is Justice Stevens was a naval intelligence officer, so he might have
Well, that may have influenced his views. That's fair. Although not, super conservative when it comes to law enforcement generally throughout his career. But I think it reflects the tension in the federal judiciary at all levels about the way the Fourth Amendment applies to new technology. So it'll be worth seeing what happens when Magistrate Fitchell goes forward with this proceeding.
So he's asking the EFF what consumers understand about their location data?
Yeah, I think he's collecting information from EFF and I think from others, and I think he's asked the government to answer specific questions too about the way the phones work and about what consumers' expectations are about how their phones work.
So why don't we just ask a few people, how do you think phone calls get to you when you move? do you think they just, it's magic, or
right.
Does the cell tower know where you are?
Right.
At bottom, anybody who's thought about it has to recognize that the phone company knows a fair amount about where they are at any given time.
I don't know why you guys give poor Judge Facciola such a hard time. I mean, he clearly reads our client advisories because he's touched on two issues we've written an awful lot about and which have divided the courts. And he said that. I mean, that this issue has struck a real profound chord in district courts and I think in some courts of appeals, although I can't remember for sure. And, you know, it's unusual for a magistrate to be someone who looks across the spectrum of courts in the United States and says, you know, I want to take this on and write a lengthy opinion, but he has, you know, to his credit, he has identified two very real issues that need to be resolved at a much higher level, but he's going to do his damnedest to set a factual record. And
well, but isn't he proposing to resolve them without any appeal to any higher court? He can't, if he rules on this, then the government loses. That's it. It's over. There's no way to get a subpoena or a warrant for this information, right?
Well, I mean, eventually it'll get reviewed, even if his decision isn't reviewable by a district court judge in this matter. Eventually, you know, all these things get resolved, and the government can find a way to get around him.
Okay.
So I'm sure Jason has a bunch of ideas for how to do that expeditiously.
Right. Although, as a practical matter, if he denies the request and the government is unable to get this information, the government doesn't really have a natural vehicle to challenge it. If he grants the request and the government gets it, then there'll be a motion to suppress and it can be resolved that way. But it is a constant source of frustration for the government that it's unable to efficiently resolve these splits. I mean, Michael's right that this is an issue that's divided the courts since at least 2004, 2005. And about 50% of the reported opinions have held that at least for prospective data, you need a warrant. And the other half have said that the authority under the statute is specific and articulable facts and that's the standard. You shouldn't have a situation in which the standards that apply to law enforcement depend on what courthouse you're standing in, or in some cases, which magistrate you're in front of in the same building. But the government doesn't have a readily available vehicle for getting those disputes resolved without legislation because these orders are not reviewable.
Let's turn to what I thought was maybe the most significant development of the week in cybersecurity, which is that the SEC is giving detailed cybersecurity guidance for examination of companies that it's reviewing, and looks as though lots and lots of questions. Chris Conti, who worked at the SEC for many years and returned to Steptoe in the last, 2 years, right?
Yep, 2-3.
Has been following this. Tell us what they did and maybe what it means.
Sure. Well, you're right. 28 questions, but multiple subparts in tremendous detail based, off of the NIST framework that came out in February. So
they're already using that framework.
Yeah. I think this might be the first time a regulatory agency's done that. It came out of the National Exam Priority that OC identified earlier in the year. They're going to be going out
OC?
OC is the Office of Compliance Inspections and Examinations, they're going to be going out to over 50 broker-dealers and investment advisors. And what's interesting about this is by sharing the information ahead of time, you're really sending, you know, sort of dual messages, I think. One is, look, we want you to be prepared because we view the, you know, cybersecurity preparedness as incredibly important and significant to the integrity of the markets and the protection of customer data. SEC is still very much in the information gathering, mode, and Chair White talked about forging a greater partnership between private and government sectors to deal with these cyber threats. But at the same time, by giving the information requests and document requests out, the alert actually talks about empowering compliance officials and companies
inside the companies.
Companies, they're going to run to their executives and they're going to say, look, this is what we need to be ready for. Give me the dollars. Give me the resources, because we've got to be prepared both from a compliance perspective, but also we need to understand what our risks are. This will really incentivize, I think, the regulated entities of the world, but also public companies too, to take a look at this roadmap, this blueprint, as a way to both deal with you know, kind of what best practices and expectations are, and to begin to dedicate the resources to get there.
So presumably comptroller, all the banking examiners could use something similar to this so that it would spread to the financial sector. What about SEC-regulated public companies? They're not subject to these questions, are they?
Specifically, you're right. They're not, because these are going to be used in exams for regulated entities. But when you look at the areas that they address, you know, when there are like six or seven areas that are all spelled out, they are in many respects not unique to investment advisors and broker deals, have broad applicability to public companies as well. And so they would provide just as ready a roadmap and blueprint for public companies to assess preparedness, policies, procedures, and the like.
And so if the SEC shows up at a public company and wants to know whether they have actually been sufficiently disclosing their cybersecurity risks, it's conceivable they could ask some variant of these questions?
I think that they'll be, although they wouldn't be showing up technically in the sense of sending examiners after the fact if an investigation is opened. This is a series of questions against which a public company would then be evaluated for purposes of, you know, whether they had policies, procedures in effect, and then they would begin to evaluate their disclosures around events, and how quickly they identified, issues and what their, disclosure policies and procedures were and whether they were effective or not. So this sets a framework, if you will, for an after the fact assessment of whether a company had been in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, it's interesting because getting it out this early means it potentially does become a template for all the other regulatory agencies that have some kind of inspection authority, which is certainly the financial industries, but probably others as well.
Sure. And I think it goes back to the recognition that Chair White said that there's got to be a partnership. I don't think the regulators, at least the SEC, are quite at the gotcha stage where the investigations are going to start flying out the door, because I think they recognize the importance of really raising, the level of compliance throughout so many entities.
Well, that's cool. Michael, speaking of raising the level, is it true that the very last state to pass a data breach law has now acted, or are there still a couple that haven't adopted one?
Kentucky last week became the 47th state to pass a breach notification law, and we still got Alabama, New Mexico, and South Dakota who are the outliers still. It's interesting. The Kentucky law is pretty narrowly written. Clearly, business had a lot to do in crafting this law. It has a fairly high risk of harm threshold, which means that you don't have to notify affected individuals unless the breach actually causes or leads the company to reasonably believe that the breach has caused or will cause identity theft or fraud against an affected individual. That's pretty high bar. It also allows companies to delay notifying so that they can take any measures necessary to determine the scope of the breach and restore the integrity of the system. So it gives businesses a fairly broad amount of discretion, I think, in determining whether and when to notify.
Now, that's interesting. So even though they're late to the party, they're sort of showing why they were late to the party. They were worried about excess regulation, and they've written a narrow statute.
I think that's the charitable interpretation.
All right.
We should always give state legislators, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I have to say, the next guy is somebody I've never felt particularly charitable about. He's really right up there with Edward Snowden in terms of unlikely heroes, or maybe jackasses who've become surprisingly heroes, to the libertarian crowd. Andrew Auernheimer, who did the AT&T hack, where he revealed vast numbers of fairly well-known people's email addresses, beat the rap, or at least temporarily beat the rap. Jason, can you describe what that case was about and how he managed to get out?
Sure, at least for now.
Yes.
So, as you alluded to, he and a co-conspirator broke into AT&T servers, and they stole about 114,000, 115,000 email addresses from iPad users back in, I think, 2010, and then provided that data to the website Gawker. What they actually did was they discovered a security flaw in the AT&T website that left exposed a combination of people, users' email addresses, and then the ID number used to authenticate iPads on the AT&T network. And they wrote a program, which they called the Slurper, to collect that data, and then they provided it to Gawker. Didn't help their cause that the email addresses they appropriated included Mayor Bloomberg's, then White House Chief of Staff, I think the Attorney General, a number of other DOJ, DOD, and DHS officials. And in chats, they admitted to, I think, an undercover, to an informant, that they did this to embarrass AT&T and to promote themselves, not for purely charitable or network security motives. The co-conspirator who helped write the program pled guilty, sort of undermining the overall argument that this was not a crime. Weave himself was sentenced was convicted of trial and sentenced to 41 months for violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. He was prosecuted in federal court in New Jersey, despite the fact that he was from Arkansas, his co-conspirator was in San Francisco, and the servers that he broke into were in Dallas and Atlanta. But the victim company itself was located in New Jersey. Which is largely what gave rise to that office being aggressive and stepping forward to prosecute the case. Like Aaron Schwartz's case, Weave's case has, to critics of the CFA, become a cause celeb. They've used as an illustration of what they consider to be overreach. But like in Aaron Schwartz's case, I don't think there's any question that the conduct he engaged in constituted a crime, and as I said, his co-conspirator pled guilty to it. He made news last week, as you said, because the conviction got thrown out, but not on substantive grounds, but on venue grounds. The Third Circuit said that, the federal court in New Jersey was the wrong place to have prosecuted the crime because the crime had no significant connection, if any, to the state, and that he should have been prosecuted elsewhere. The question remains whether the Justice Department will go forward and prosecute him again. The sentence was 41 months. Looked this morning, but wasn't readily able to figure out how much time of that sentence he's actually served. DOJ will have to do the calculus and decide whether it's worth pursuing again. But it is, as is often the case, the people that there aren't a lot of readily available, legitimate poster children for overuse of the CFAA. Reasonable people could disagree with me about whether Aaron Schwartz is one, but I find it harder to disagree about whether this guy is one.
So the argument, if I understand it, is at the end of the day, he just went to a website that was available like any other website and took publicly available information. Now, it happened that the way AT&T had set this up, you could just enter one piece of information and it would take you to a website that was set up to you to give you your ID, if I remember right. So, that it was relative, they had set it up in the hopes that no one would figure out that that's how they were doing it, and Auernheimer and his guys figured it out. And then all they did was the equivalent, of, if I understand it, of going to a public website and looking at publicly available information. That was their argument, that that it was not enough protection for the data for it to be an unauthorized access.
Right.
And you can certainly think of circumstances where going to someplace public is something that the person who put it up there regrets and would like to tell you in, after the fact was not authorized. So I think he's a jerk and a griefer, but I actually wonder if the Justice Department ended up with worse law here than if that argument had been upheld. Because when you start an investigation, you have no idea where the perp is going to end up being. And the idea that you will do an entire investigation out of New Jersey and then just meekly hand the case to some guy in, you know, New Mexico or Los Angeles and expect him to pursue it with the same enthusiasm you showed in the investigation is improbable. And I actually wonder whether the Justice Department isn't going to face a lot more discouragement of CFAA cases by people saying, well, you know, I might end up doing all this work and getting nothing out of it.
You know, this case was unusual at the time because for the most part, these cases get pursued by prosecutor's offices in the locations where the servers are located.
Right.
And so the fact that this was done not in Dallas, not in Atlanta, and not even where the defendant was in Arkansas, but was done in New Jersey, I think, struck me as an unusual choice at the time. So I think it may be one of those situations where it's fairly limited to its facts. But I do think, you know, I think you very nicely sort of summarized the argument that he's put forward publicly. And I think at trial, I think the government's argument would be, you know, just because a bank leaves its door open doesn't mean you can walk in and take anything you want. It wasn't available to the public in the sense that anybody could get it. It was a door that was left open that shouldn't have been. And it's still a crime to go in there.
And he had some very bad statements about knowing that he was doing something that was subterranean and that was going to cause massive pain.
And that it was clear. He made clear in his chats that that was his motive, which certainly didn't help his cause.
Well, Michael, the question of the week that I kind of am gobsmacked by is whether the First Amendment protects the ability of a Chinese government-influenced search engine to say, we're not going to tell you about Tiananmen Square and the massacre there because, you know, that's our First Amendment right to give you search terms that don't include that when you put Tiananmen Square in your search engine. Can you give us a little background on that issue?
Yeah, it's, you know, as distasteful and ironic as the result is, I think it's actually a fairly well-reasoned and ultimately correct decision. And this is sort of akin to the court saying in the 70s that the Nazi party could put on a parade in Skokie, Illinois, where one out of six Jewish residents were either survivors of the Holocaust or directly related to survivors. The issue here was whether Baidu could suppress search results in the United States that that led to information about pro-democracy efforts in China and advocacy of greater democracy. The court said that Baidu, you know, as a company that operates in the United States, has a First Amendment right to make editorial decisions about what content it shows on its site. And, you know, there are flip sides to that editorial judgment. You decide what you're going to publish and what you're not going to publish. And even though here the decision was about they're not publishing certain web results, the court saw them as flip sides of the same thing. And, you know, the reasoning was that if the court had somehow enjoined Baidu from suppressing these results, that that was going to be governmental action and therefore violating the First Amendment.
So the theory is the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law, and that doesn't include the Politburo in the People's Republic of China. So the First Amendment has nothing to say about that.
Yeah, I mean, but here, to me, that's the interesting question about whether what the government action is, or what the state action is. But I think there is ample case law saying that when courts get involved in cases like this, that they are effectively the state actor. The issue about whether a website is protected by the First Amendment and its editorial judgments, surprisingly, is not often litigated. You would think that would come up all the time. And I think probably the reason it doesn't come up as often as you might expect is because of the Communications Decency Act, which gives websites immunity for those sorts of decisions. So you can decide these cases on statutory grounds without having to go to the Constitution.
So the European Union, if I remember right, just told Google that Google has to display certain competitors' sites at least as prominently, maybe more prominently than Google's own properties, raising the question whether they are violating the First Amendment when they do that, or whether they can say, well, in the United States, you can do what you want, but we will punish you if you do it. So why don't you tell the court that this is your choice and your First Amendment choice?
Awesome.
All right. Okay. Moving on, at least until we can get Michael back. It's this week in Bitcoin again, because there have been a couple of new developments there. A new candidate for Satoshi Nakamoto, and I thought actually a more plausible argument about who might have been speaking for Nakamoto. And Mt. Gox is hoping to get back a little bit of it, of the money that it's lost. Jason, what's going on?
Well, Satoshi Nakamoto seems to be a title that no one wants. Or certainly no one wants publicly. You'll recall from a previous episode that a few months ago, Newsweek identified a man in California whose name at birth was Satoshi Nakamoto as the founder of Bitcoin, and he not surprisingly denied it. Now the attention is focused on a blogger named Nick Szabo, who has written a lot about Bitcoin, and there have been two studies of his writing, including one by a university this week, which concluded that his writing had an uncanny resemblance to the writing of the person who put together the original Bitcoin paper.
I'm a big believer in those studies because I've looked at my own stuff and it's sort of embarrassing how predictable it is. It's very hard to suppress, right? Those sort of ticks, verbal ticks, just keep showing up no matter how hard you work at it.
I mean, it certainly seemed to be as plausible as the collection of facts that pointed Newsweek toward the other guy, and it's really unclear whether it's one or the other, or whether Satoshi Nakamoto is one person at all. You know, as you know, there's been speculation throughout that it's actually a group of people using that name collectively, and it's possible that Nick Szabo is one of them, and it's also possible that the gentleman in California is one of them, but they're both denying it. In the meantime, as you alluded to, Mt. Gox is fighting on what I think is an uphill battle, trying to get some of its seize money back from the U.S. government. Mt. Gox went bankrupt, as listeners to the podcast will remember. They're still missing hundreds of millions of dollars in customer money. They have about 127,000 creditors who are demanding their money back, and they're in bankruptcy proceedings in Japan. Actually, just this week or last week, asked the court to make the proceeding a liquidation rather than a restructuring, making it, I guess, significantly less likely that those 127,000 people are going to see their money back. And in the meantime, they're trying to get, in U.S. court, they're trying to get $5 million back that was seized by Homeland Security agents, which is, about as likely as they're going back into business.
Yeah. And would be, you know, a teaspoon in the ocean in any event.
That's right.
Well, Michael, I think, you got, cut off while we were, trying to close up on the, question of, what search engines' First Amendment rights are, and we were raising the question whether it's possible the EU's effort to regulate the commercial impact of dominance by one search engine might run afoul of the First Amendment.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, I don't know why the Chinese government would want to shut me down when I was actually saying that its favor was good. It was probably a knee-jerk reaction to anything I say online. Yeah, it's going to be interesting how this plays out and how effects of the EU extend to this. I think it's hard to predict. And I think it'll be a while probably before U.S. courts even take take these questions up anymore, since they do come up so infrequently.
Yeah, if you're Vladimir Putin and you're smart about the West, you could say, all I need to do is make it commercially unappealing to have certain search terms showing up, and then lean on U.S.-based search engine providers, who will then, you know, they can't be told by the U.S. government to play it straight because of the First Amendment, but they can be told by me that they're not going to be doing business in Russia if they don't bias their search terms in favor of the view that I would like to see. You know, I'd like to see Russia Times high on the search list. And I'm not sure that, you know, Google has begun to use its search discretion in ways that are that go beyond even trying to prevent spammers from succeeding. They recently announced that they were going to, or they were thinking about giving a priority in search terms to people who use SSL, that is to say encryption, as part of their user experience, as a way of encouraging SSL, which has nothing to do with how good the search results are and everything to do with pushing a particular policy.
Yeah, and you see websites like Twitter now complying with government demands to tailor their services. And Twitter agreeing, I think, to limit its service in Turkey in response to enormous pressure from the government there. And I think we're going to continue to see that, even though a lot of companies like Google will make strong public statements. At the end of the day, a lot of them will say it's more important for us to be doing business in these totalitarian countries, and so we'll do whatever it takes.
Yeah, so the next frontier is when they start being asked to suppress these things outside of the country that's affected, and that'll be a much tougher fight for the governments to win, but they could win it.
Yep.
Okay, well, that's the week in cyber law, and it's now my pleasure to introduce Alex Joel. Alex and I have appeared on multiple programs together, and it's always been a pleasure. Welcome.
Thank you, Stuart. It's a pleasure to be here.
I guess I ought to start out with, what actually does the Civil Liberties Protection Officer and the DNI's office do?
My position is actually defined in the law that created the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. When the 9/11 Commission issued its report, you will recall that Congress considered the report, considered the different recommendations, and ended up passing the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004 that created the Office of the Director of National Intelligence to help lead and integrate the intelligence community, 17 elements of the intelligence community, so that we could better connect the dots, you know, pick your metaphor, and prevent another 9/11 from happening. And when they did that, they decided to create as well the Civil Liberties Protection Officer position to have responsibility for both privacy and civil liberties. I know you had Dan Sutherland here earlier. He occupied, as he described to you, and as you, of course, well know, the Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. He was the Civil Rights and Civil Liberties Officer at DHS. So my position in the bill is actually something of a combination between Dan's old job at DHS and then the privacy officer's job at DHS, but implemented in its own way, of course, for the intelligence community. So I help the intelligence agencies decide how to best protect privacy and civil liberties while carrying out our intelligence mission. So how do we do both? And I'm a big proponent of something that I call, we all have different metaphors, but I like the balance metaphor. Not the balance in the way that the courts may sort of weigh one thing versus the other and then choose one over the other, which is sometimes what happens with Fourth Amendment jurisprudence or First Amendment jurisprudence, but rather I like to think of it as the need to maintain the balance between national security, protecting national security, and protecting privacy and civil liberties. So we really have to do both. It's not a choice for us, either or. Of course, there are tensions between the two, so it's hard to figure out exactly how to keep that balance in different situations. So I've been working in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence since stand-up. I've worked for all four directors of national intelligence. providing advice and also conducting oversight activities as well. So, for example, with NSA, we work very closely with the Department of Justice and, of course, the people at NSA to oversee how those how their authorities are being implemented under the FISA Amendments Act. And we issue reports based on that as well. So it's been a fascinating few years, actually about a decade that I've been doing this. And in particular, the last year has been extremely busy.
Yes, I think it's probably been you've been more prominent in the last year than all the remaining years combined because of the Snowden issues.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because one dynamic I noticed was it's not like I didn't try to do outreach and speak to the public and speak to the media before the current situation. I certainly did. And we would have sessions with media. I'd be on the record. I like to say that I'm the intelligence official who has said the most in public, but had the least quoted by any news media, because I think it was hard for the journalists to really understand or feel like the information I was providing to them was a story. You know, I think journalists and human beings are story driven. And having an official say, look, it's a difficult balance. We're trying to maintain it. It's challenging. Here are the kinds of things I can publicly describe to you in terms of the policies and the procedures and how we deal with the legal environment and how we have oversight by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and Congress. Before the Snowden disclosures, I think what they heard was blah, 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 blah. And they really wanted me to what they actually directly asked before was, could I tell them of any intelligence abuses? Because that would be a story.
Right.
But this talk about the care that we take and how difficult some of these issues are and how much time and attention we spend on them was not in their minds a story.
Yeah. Well, you could assemble a budget. How much money is spent on FOIA and privacy protection? The number of people that NSA now has working in their general counsel's office, in their compliance office, in their privacy office is quite substantial. Now, they've got a lot of people, but in fact, my bet is if you looked at, say, the time budget of the director of NSA, civil liberties protection issues probably consume a double-digit share of a percentage share of his time.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. If you look at resources and amount of attention that is being spent on these issues by top leadership, it's certainly spiked recently, but it's always been at a significant level. And in fact, if you look back at the debates for the IRTPA, what we saw.
So this is the Intelligence Reform Act that led to the creation of the DNI.
That's right. So back in 2003, 2004, when they were debating the 9/11 Commission recommendations and thinking about how to reform the intelligence community, and they were initially discussing the first version of the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, the creation of my position, the potential creation of other civil liberties and privacy officer positions around the intelligence community. What you see are statements of concern that they didn't want intelligence officers looking over their shoulders and being too conservative. In light of what we learned after 9/11, you know, where there was this wall that was perceived to have been created because of legal interpretations. They didn't want intelligence officers hesitating too much before taking action to protect the nation, out of some, you know, perhaps misunderstanding of what the rules actually allowed them to do. And of course, now we are many years beyond that. And I think the view has changed and there's a strong push for, well, how much oversight do you have? Can we add to that oversight? Can we add to the civil liberties and privacy protections that are already in place? And that's going to have, and I'm in favor of all those things. I think, you know, that's part of my job, but it will have a resource cost to it.
And a caution cost.
Yes.
We will have a risk-averse national security agency for a decade, is my guess.
Yes, I think, So I think our challenge is to try to find ways to make sure that the intelligence agencies can still, of course, be effective, but do so in a new environment. And I think a lot of that is strategic planning, it's resources, it's culture. I think a lot of things have to be looked at anew.
So thinking about that, I would have guessed that when Congress adopted the provision creating your office, and indeed when you started your office, you probably didn't think, and they didn't think, that protecting civil liberties included protecting the civil liberties of our intelligence targets. Now the question, you know, in light of the international reaction when the first response to the Snowden leaks was to say, don't worry, we protect the privacy of Americans, was for 95% of humanity to say, well, that's no good at all for us. There have been efforts, and I think the president's policy directives suggest that there's an effort to say, no, we're going to protect everybody's civil liberties. Can you describe what, at bottom, the president is telling the intelligence agencies they need to do?
So what you're referring to is what we call Presidential Policy Directive 28, which was issued in January at the same time that the president gave his speech on national security in January. And in that speech and in that directive, I think he makes clear that it's important for us to think about privacy of everyone around the world, not only because it's the right thing to do, but it's also because it's important to build confidence among our international partners as well as with the American people. So that's really something that we have taken seriously. The directive has given us a series of deadlines that we are working hard to meet. There are interagency sessions going on right now trying to implement the various aspects of PPD 28 is how we refer to that directive. And we have met with EU, particularly members of the European Union governing structure, different bodies in the EU, to try to explain to them what we're doing and to hear from them directly what their concerns might be.
Really, we ought to just have Victoria Nuland meet with them and explain their status every time. Victoria Nuland is famous for having been wiretapped by the Russians, who then published her conversation in which she said, screw the EU, or words to that effect. They don't protect our civil liberties in any realistic sense. Why are we bending over backwards to give them assurances about what we're going to do, especially since they're only going to try to turn them into legally binding assurances?
I think it's very important for us to reassure everybody that we are being very careful with everyone's personal information, which we are. I mean, I think if you look historically at what intelligence agencies do, and you see what the president has said about this, there's an impression that the intelligence agencies are out there indiscriminately collecting information on average people for just because we can. Right. So this goes to the president's formulation. We shouldn't do things just because we can, and we don't, as you will remember from your time at NSA, not only are their resources limited and that's simply a physical impossibility, but also it's just not in the mission of the intelligence agencies to do that. They have no interest in it, and by law and by culture and by presidential directive and by what they're here to do, what we're all here to do, it is not to spy on everybody. It is to protect the security of the United States and to serve the national interests of this country, which in many ways help our partners as well around the world and are very important for them. And it's not, of course, as you know, different from what other foreign intelligence services do with respect to their activities. And so I do think it would be helpful if we had a more global conversation around intelligence as opposed to one that simply focuses on NSA. I understand why we're having the conversation on NSA, because we've had these series of disclosures regarding what NSA does, but it does make it an unbalanced and, I think, somewhat inaccurate conversation in terms of making it seem as if we're unique in some way around the world, when in fact, as you know, this is how intelligence services in democracies generally operate.
Well, it's how all intelligence agencies operate, in the sense that they're focused on gathering intelligence that is useful to their governments. But in terms of being governed by the rule of law, and by being cautious about, people's privacy, the National Security Agency and the U.S. intelligence community generally are leagues ahead of even the Western European democracies, which are far less regulated, although increasingly regulated.
Yeah, I don't want to, you know, I certainly don't want to speak ill of how other countries regulate their intelligence services.
Well, that's right, I'll do that.
we each have our own way of doing it, and in the European Union, the member states have their own ways of regulating the their intelligence services, and I think there are more parallels than there are differences. We do have very rigorous controls here, including much more involvement of the judiciary than I think you'll find than in most any other country around the world, including the countries in Europe. But that said, they do have their own ways of regulating their intelligence services. But it's important to note that, and I know that you've noted this, the European Union's governing structure does not extend to the member states and how they regulate their intelligence.
The only intelligence agency they think they have authority to regulate it is ours, if I understand it.
They certainly are in discussions with us about how we regulate ours, yes.
But the president is giving ground, at least at the level of principle there. He has, in PPD 28, said that you do need to protect the privacy of foreign targets, and that you can't gather intelligence for the purpose of disadvantaging persons based on their ethnicity, race, gender, sexual orientation, or religion.
Right.
Can we explore that a little? Obviously, there are people who believe that their religion is best expressed by killing Americans in bulk. We want to know who those people are, and we want to disadvantage the hell out of them. How do you square that reality with the president's language?
Right. So I think in that case, we're not, of course, spying on indiscriminately on people of a particular religion or a particular faith. The people who are members of these foreign terrorist organizations have taken a narrative and used it for their own purposes. And so it's perfectly legitimate, in my view, for us to review and analyze how they're using that narrative as a method for recruitment or as a, you know, as a method for motivating their followers to incite them to violence against the United States and U.S. interests around the world. So that's not disadvantaging people because of their religion. It's studying the methods of a particular foreign terrorist organization or groups of organizations.
So, the language there is followed almost immediately by saying signals intelligence shall be collected exclusively where there's a foreign intelligence or counterintelligence purpose. So is the distinction between the two that on the one hand, if the purpose is just to disadvantage people out of racial or ethnic or sexual prejudice, we won't do it. But if there's a foreign intelligence purpose in gathering information on a new Islamic movement, we're free to do it as long as there's foreign intelligence value in it?
I think it's sort of different ways of describing what it is that our agencies are focused on, which is foreign intelligence information. And foreign intelligence information is not focusing on someone's religion simply because of that religion. It is rather, and you know this very well in terms of how intelligence agencies operate. The intelligence analyst comes to work every day with a particular set of tasks that are focused on national security or supporting our foreign affairs, making us effective in the global community. But very specifically with NSA, the National Security Agency, it's really focused on national security. And so therefore, what they then choose to analyze, how they carry out their work, all has that focus. They're not out there saying, oh, let me take a look at followers of a particular religion or a particular ethnic group just because it's interesting to me personally or because I have a prejudice against somebody or anything like that. That would be wrong according to the PPD and also contrary to how intelligence agencies operate.
So if you had an analyst come in and said, you know, I think Vladimir Putin, he's probably gay. I mean, look at all those bare-chested photos. The guy's got issues. Would that be a legitimate foreign intelligence inquiry? Would clearly undermine his narrative to discover that. Is that a legitimate inquiry?
I'm not going to comment. I won't touch that one. I'm not going to touch that one.
All right. Come on, Vladimir. Come and get me. So there are other things in here that I thought were interesting. The president has said we're not going to do intelligence gathering to afford a competitive advantage to U.S. companies, which
right.
is part of the pitch we've been making,
right.
Saying to people we actually do less intelligence gathering than most. Certainly Snowden has been going as close as he could to accuse us of commercial espionage. My sense is, despite our reiteration of that, we're not getting any traction at all out of saying we don't do this. Nobody that's an important foreign audience seems particularly to believe that or impressed by it. So my question is, do we really want to be writing this into a presidential directive at precisely the time when it isn't doing us any good and when we might decide it's appropriate to do some commercial espionage? Suppose we discovered a company had stolen a bunch of the technology from a U.S. defense contractor and was using it to build products and then improving that technology for a foreign power. Would it be appropriate to go in and steal all their improvements and give it back to their victim?
So, I won't comment on the specific scenario, but just in general, we have, of course, already put it into the PPD. The president has said it, and we don't engage in that kind of an activity. So the context in which he's, and I take your point that maybe it's not gaining a lot of traction, and we can have a separate, and I think we will have a separate discussion around transparency and how we can better communicate with the public on a range of topics, given the constraints we're under. But it is true that we don't engage in that kind of activity. I've been working in the community for many years. I certainly haven't seen it, and I see the opposite. I see a lot of care taken, given the way that our economy works. And I know that you discussed an aspect of this in your last podcast when you were talking about antitrust. The extraordinary and the extraordinarily litigious nature of our society, the fact that we're based on free enterprise, it is hard for me to imagine a situation setting. I know you're going to throw different specific scenarios at me.
No, I promise. I'm done with that.
But it's hard to imagine a specific scenario where we would go to a particular company and essentially advantage them over their competitors. It's just not the way our society is set up. It's just not the way our economy works, and it's not the way the government works. And we go through quite a bit of effort to avoid doing that.
Yeah, we're bad at it, and for good reasons. And the people who are good at it have a whole bunch of disadvantages that come with a structure that makes them good at it. I sort of agree with you, but I just wonder whether giving this kind of absolute assurance is necessarily prudent for the world that we're going to be in for the next 10 years.
I think if I could just generalize more around that, I think that's the risk that we run into with everything that we're saying in public right now. There's that statement. You can pick other statements in the PPD. Essentially, we are a rules-driven society, and I think that's a little bit hard for some people to grasp, because I think they view us as the Wild West, and you know, sort of anything goes with respect to personal information. And as you all know, that is not the case. And so once the president issues this kind of a directive, and then we implement that directive in terms of policy, as you know, there's a whole bureaucratic structure that kicks in, including, but not limited to inspections and audits by the inspector general.
My experience is every step it goes down in the bureaucracy, people move farther and farther away from the line, to make sure they don't get close to the line.
Right.
And by the time you get down to the actual operator, he's so far back from the line, he can't see it from where he sits.
That is a risk, especially the more complicated you try to make the rule to account for different, issues that might come up. As that rule gets simplified, as it has to be, as it goes down the line to the frontline operator, sometimes they completely simplify that to say, you know what, I am just not going to touch any of that. I'm going to stay completely away from that, because the worst thing that could happen to me as an analyst or as a frontline operator is I'm violating a rule in a bureaucracy, and then I'm going to be punished for violating that rule. And that's goes back to the conversation we had about what people were concerned with immediately after 9/11. Some people were concerned with, which was that we were going to create too many rules that would constrain our analysts and our operators from doing what they needed to do. And so it is a challenge. And I think every time we say, but I just want to say that that's why these things are meaningful. So when we do say this in a PPD, or we say this in, as you know, in statute, or when the court issues something, the way that American agencies react is to say, okay, this is what it means. This is how we're going to train on it. This is how we're going to oversee compliance with it. This is how incidents of noncompliance will be handled, will be reported. The IGs will then have their own plan for inspecting and auditing. Other organizations will be set up to manage that as well. As you mentioned, NSA has many, many dozens. I think John has publicly announced how many people he has. John DeLong, the director of compliance, working for him, which is a large number. So it is, there are consequences. These aren't just rhetorical statements in a speech.
So speaking of writing rules into law, we're going to have to redo the 215 program, it appears, right, since everyone believes that it can't survive in its current form. What's the status of the drafting there? The HPSI has come out with a draft. The president, snarked on their draft and said he had a better idea. Have we seen his actual proposal yet?
I think the way it's being handled right now is that it's an ongoing discussion with the different committees. And as you've pointed out, there's at least one draft. There are other drafts floating around. So obviously Congress is going to have to figure out how to put forward a bill that deals with the situation, and the administration is providing consultation on that process as it goes forward.
Is it possible there won't be an administration bill, just a bill that comes out that has the president's blessing?
It's possible. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know exactly where that's going to end up at the moment.
Yeah, that often is a smarter thing to do when you're the president.
I think
with the other party.
Yeah, I think there's a challenge here, obviously, because the different committees have different views in terms of how they want to see this work itself out, and it's a topic that has gotten the public as manifested through different groups and voices, very engaged, and so I'm not sure exactly where it's going to end up, but in the meantime, we have implemented some changes to the program, so the court is pre-approving the query terms essentially being used on the database, and each individual one. And we went from the three hops to the two hops, so that's been announced.
And how is that process with the court going? Have you seen a tailing off in the number of searches?
My understanding is that they've worked it out so that it's proceeding acceptably, but it's not proceeding with the speed with which it did before the court was involved in individualized approvals.
Can you say how long it takes the court usually to
I don't know. I mean, I have a sense for it, but I don't want to I would want to go back and check.
Okay. My guess is that there's the court probably wasn't enthusiastic about doing this in the first place, and certainly doesn't feel that it ought to speed up its normal deliberative process. If I remember right, when they do FISA orders, they're full of questions. I mean, it's not just yes or no. It's they demonstrate that they're being good overseers by asking a boatload of questions. And that means they have to think up the questions, which takes days, if not weeks. And then the questions have to get answered, which take days, if not weeks, which is quite different. Well, not completely different, but different from the process whereby the people who are doing this go to the general counsel and say, these are the folks and these are the reasons I want to search for them.
Right. I mean, that's all exactly right. And I think, as you may recall from your time in there, whenever something gets presented to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, it is very heavily reviewed and worked on by teams of folks in the executive branch before it even goes over to the court. Then the court advisors see it, and then there's some back and forth. And this has now been publicly described by the court itself, and changes are made. I mean, and the level of documentation involved is very surprising. I think for people outside the process when they first see it, there's, you know, an application for a FISA order can be dozens and dozens of pages long, where people might look at it and say, well, this seems like a fairly routine request, and yet it has to have very substantial documentation and has to be very heavily reviewed. So I think it shows the care that the FISA court takes in these things. And it's an interesting part of the public narrative also, because when the story first broke back in June, there were a lot of, I think, statements that you saw in the public discussion that the FISA court was a rubber stamp. Essentially, it had a rubber stamp, I guess, and we could just go to the court with anything, and then they would stamp it approved. And for those of us who had experience on the inside, this was, of course, a complete fantasy, that the FISA court was by no means a rubber stamp. And I think that narrative has now shifted, although you may be a better judge of that than I am, because of the FISA court opinions that have been released that have been very critical in some cases of the government, and of the court's own statements where it's basically said, hey, we're not a rubber stamp. We look at the stuff very carefully. We examine it. And they've released some statistics that show that they modify a significant percentage of the stuff that comes in front of them more than other courts do when they receive similar matters. So hopefully we're beyond this notion that they're a rubber stamp, because they are by no means a rubber stamp.
Well, I'd hope so, because the last time they got accused of being a rubber stamp, they worked so hard to overcome that impression that they created the wall more or less from whole cloth and imposed it on the FBI precisely at the time where it prevented the FBI from using its resources to find the hijackers that they knew were in the country. FISA court was well protected by classified information from having that story told until well past the event. But it was a very costly bit of PR on their part to overcome the rubber stamp label. A couple of things that I know Michael wanted to raise and that I was interested in too. When I debate Snowden, whether he's a patriot, whether he's a hero or not, I would say that one of the most frequent responses is, are you kidding? We saw the clips where Jim Clapper lied about this program. If the government is lying about that, they'll lie about anything. I have to say that episode is really damaging to the entire intelligence community's credibility. Michael, I'm stealing your thunder. Weigh in if you want, but I think the question was, did you have any role in that before or after the question was asked and answered? Are we going to hear more about it? Is there a sort of final accounting, because there have been more than one explanation for how that came about? And I think if you're willing to explore that with us, it would be very helpful.
Sure. I did not have a personal role in it before. Obviously, afterwards I have. And he has, Director Clapper has explained this in a public letter. He personally explained it to Senator Wyden. He explained it to the members of the committee He's been very anguished about the public reaction and about his statement, and I'm sure if he had to do it over again, he would have done it differently. So he, in his letter, he admitted publicly that it was a mistake, that he shouldn't have said what he said, and he also explained what led him to the answer that he gave. And I think if you look at the transcript, you can see what he was talking about. And I will tell you you asked me for my role. I remember personally reading the transcript and thinking the same thing that Director Clapper thought when the question was asked by Senator Wyden. We were both mistaken in terms of what Senator Wyden was asking about. So going back, this was a threat hearing. It was about other things. And in the midst of that, Senator Wyden starts asking about whether or not it's true that NSA has dossiers on millions of Americans, because he alluded to a speech that General Alexander had given, in which he had said NSA does not have digital dossiers on millions of Americans. And so Senator Wyden alludes to that speech, and this is also in the context of other discussions involving Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which is a whole different program and a whole different type of authority. And what Director Clapper, as you see the back and forth between them, what Director Clapper thought he was asking about was essentially Section 702. Under Section 702, do we collect information on millions of Americans, or words to that effect, is what he heard. And he said, no, except perhaps incidentally, or words to that effect.
Not wittingly.
And what he meant was the incidental collections. And we knew, of course, at the time that Senator Wyden was very focused on incidental collection of information, and still is, that may be going on under that program. And he's also was concerned at the time, and still is, about the use, the ability that we have to query Section 702 data using U.S. person identifiers. And so he gave that response. We were later advised by the staff of Senator Wyden that, no, Senator Wyden meant the Section 215 program. And, you know, so Director Clapper's answer is an error. And I, at least, did not think at the time that this would be the purpose of the question, because as we had made clear to the SSCI on numerous occasions, the fact of the existence of that particular program was classified. So as you know, when the fact of the existence of the program is classified, you can't talk about that. You can't give an indication that program even exists.
So you couldn't quite believe that he was so irresponsible as to try to ask a question the answer to which would inevitably disclose a program.
I won't put it that way. I'll just say that it didn't occur to me that was what he was asking. It just literally did not occur to me because the fact of it was clear, there was no misunderstanding, at least in my mind. I thought we had made very clear that the fact of the program was classified. I knew that he didn't like that. And we had tried to come up with different ways, and this goes to Director Clapper's later statement, or his more recent statement, which is, if had we found a way to be more transparent about the program, that of course would have been better. And you can look back, and I can look back at my own efforts, and other people can as well, to think that we should have tried harder, and we should have, to try to be more transparent about the nature of the activity, so that we wouldn't have been in that impossible situation that Director Clapper was in. Having said that, so he thought it was about one program. It turned out to be about another. And then later he gave this interview, where he said words to the effect that was the least untruthful answer. And so that, again, he's not a trained trial attorney. He is not a public diplomat. He's an intelligence officer who has worked for 50 years in classified environments. And the ability to be able to think on your feet, as I'm trying to do here, and answer questions about classified intelligence programs without garbling and mangling and saying things that aren't, you know, as felicitous as you'd want, is a hard thing to do. So,
I find it interesting that you make what I'll call the 702 defense, because I was going to praise the, incredible increase in transparency that's occurred on your watch, and I'm sure in large part due to your efforts. But one of the problems I continue to have is the way the government talks about the 702 program, because I think it's not at all transparent, and I think it's still very misleading. And I think an honest answer, even if Clapper had talked about the 702 program, an honest answer, if he could have talked about it in an unclassified setting, would have been yes. We do maintain information about U.S. persons collected pursuant to 702. The way NSA has talked about it since the beginning is, oh, that's just incidental stuff. You know, what we're collecting is foreign intelligence from foreign communications. What they don't say is these are people abroad, non-U.S. persons abroad, who may well be talking to U.S. persons here in the United States. In many of those instances, we know they're talking to United States persons. We store that information, including the names of the United States persons. Oh, and on top of that, we can search that database for the names of those U.S. persons when we think they have significant foreign intelligence value. That's the truth of it. That's never said. At most, it might be said very recently, but it's certainly not the thing that intelligence officials say at the outset. And to me, that's been something that's just been incredibly grating. And I think to a lot of people who are well-versed in these issues, that's another issue that I think is causing unnecessary harm to the credibility of the intelligence community, because people say this is just, you're not being fully honest in describing this program.
That's interesting, because it's not that the IC is saying things that aren't true. It is true that these things are focused on, the targets are foreign intelligence or people who are identified as agents of a foreign power. Only when you realize that there's a lot more data that's sitting there that can be searched later do you realize why at least some of the reporters that talk about this, Bart Gellman being a good example, just can't write a story without making the point that you just made.
Yeah, I mean, to me it's no surprise that this is what 702 is about, because when I first read the bill that contained the language, I thought, wow, this is a big deal. Nobody seems to be getting it. And clearly Congress didn't get it when it voted to pass the bill, although...
Well, Congress did actually have a knockdown a brawl over that law, didn't they? Had to pass something twice, and only after President Obama switched sides did they finally adopt it. Isn't that right?
Fair enough. But, you know, 215, you could at least say, well, I didn't really contemplate that any tangible thing would mean a whole database of information. But 702 on its face clearly meant that you could collect information about U.S. persons as long as they weren't the ostensible target of the surveillance. But you could knowingly collect information about their communications. That was right out there. But it's the statements about it that I think have been not fully truthful. Or they've been truthful, as you say. They haven't been deceptive, but they've been misleading because they've been incomplete in critical and material ways.
That is a perfect segue to the point I was going to make about Director Clapper's statement about least untruthful. So the answer that he gave to Senator Wyden was a brief answer. So he said no, except not, unless not wittingly, or I don't have it in front of me, but words to that effect. So it was a brief answer. He knew that there was a lot at the time that still remained classified. And if you go back and look at the Andrea Mitchell interview, you can see that they were talking around this issue of, well, how do you, if you're put in this difficult position, you're trying to talk about this thing in an unclassified environment, how do you do that? And he was basically saying, when you're put in the position of having to give a short yes or no answer in a public setting, you're going to give an answer, you risk giving the kind of answer that he gave. Which even in the 702 context, as Michael is pointing out, could be seen as an incomplete answer. And so I think he should have said, I gave the least incomplete answer I could given the brevity of what I was saying. And of course, in retrospect, I think he wishes he had just said, I'll talk about that in classified session, or I'll give you a more complete answer later. Let me take that back. But on the 702 point, Michael, I think you're right that in our view, the statute has said that all along, that yes, you target people overseas for foreign intelligence purposes. They have to be non-U.S. persons. Of course, who they communicate with is there are going to be two or more sides to the communication. And so there may well be U.S. persons or people inside the United States. And that's why the statute lays out the requirement for minimization procedures. And with minimization, the whole purpose of minimization procedures in traditional FISA law, as you know, for decades, and certainly as it was described in that statute, was to deal with these communications of Americans who might be talking to a foreign intelligence target. What do you do with that information? You deal with that information in accordance with procedures that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court has approved. And actually, to Senator Wyden's credit, he tried to bring attention to this in a public way, various times, to this issue of, you know, was there some kind of a backdoor, you know, to use his phrase, to search this information? Were the minimization procedures sufficiently protective in the eyes of Congress? Could there be more transparency about these matters? So he was trying hard to bring public attention to it. Could we have done a better job at laying out the whole picture? Of course we could have done a better job. I mean, we are, and we can talk a little bit about transparency here right now. I mean, the intelligence community, as I've said in other contexts as well, is simply not designed or built to figure out how best to describe publicly what it does secretly. We're built and designed and resourced and trained, and our culture is to protect our sources and methods so that we can be effective at stealing the secrets of our adversaries. And so those are the people we hire. That's how we train them. And it's very hard for us to figure out how can we better describe in great detail what we do. And in fact, in order to deal with that very specific situation in the context of our democracy, as everyone here knows, we put in place these layers of oversight with people having the clearances and the facilities to review our classified information. So I've also heard, for example, that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court be criticized because it's a quote-unquote secret court. And that's its enormous value. Because it's secret, because it can do things in a way that protects classified information, it is able to see the most sensitive secrets of the intelligence community, and it does. And you need that ability for the judiciary to be able to continue to play its role in our democracy. So I think that's an enormous value. Now, can we do more to figure out ways to be transparent and not only to provide the documents that we've been providing with some redactions, but also to explain ourselves in plain English better? I think the answer clearly is yes.
I totally agree with you, and I get so animated about 702. Not because I think the program's illegal. I think it's not. I think it's completely consistent with the statute. It just frustrates me because I think the community is doing itself harm or has done itself harm by not being more fully descriptive of what the program's about. And I just hate to see that kind of self-inflicted wound. But I'm wondering what your day is like. I mean, is it just brawl after brawl between you and people who are trained to keep things secret and, you know, you're trying to push them to be more forthcoming and convincing that this is a new age, or are people more accepting of your role and the need to be more transparent?
I think there are a lot of people in the community who feel like we should be more transparent, and they include people at NSA, people at ODNI, the Director of National Intelligence himself feels that way. I think our challenge, there's a couple of different challenges. One is the culture and everything that I've just described, which is still very prevalent. And so whenever we have any particular document or item that I would like, for example, just use myself as an example because I know me and I know what I've done. So I'll see something in a document. I'll say, well, that's helpful to public understanding. That would be good to discuss in public. And so we'll review that on an interagency basis to see if that can be released. And it is always possible, and in fact, the intelligence services are trained to explain to you the reasons why that has been classified and cannot be declassified without harm to the national security. And this goes back for decades of practice in this area with these folks, where they're very concerned about mosaic theories and about we've released this piece of information 3 years ago and now you're going to release this piece of information, it's going to inevitably have this other consequence and it's going to compromise this particular method. And to which, you know, I tend to say, yes, okay, but, you know, it's important right now for public understanding, so can we just go forward with this? But there are a lot of people who do feel that we do need more transparency. And one of the challenges that I think we have going forward is how do we institutionalize this? How do we resource it? How do we put in place the processes so that this happens, not only historically looking at documents, but going forward, figuring out how can we better describe the new stuff that may be going on, and that's going to be difficult.
Well, let me offer at least a bit of lemonade coming out of that. Edward Snowden claimed, I disclosed these problems and abuses to many people and tried to raise the concern, but it just was hopeless. And then he has said, well, really, I decided to disclose these documents when I saw Clapper lie on TV. What I think is significant about that is if he was following Ron Wyden's statements, he knew that Wyden for a year or two had been campaigning on this 215 issue, had been saying the American people would be shocked at what's being done under the authority of 215, the amount of information that's being gathered, we should disclose it. We didn't know necessarily what he was talking about, but Snowden did. Right? Snowden had access to this document. And so his claim that, well, I was hopeless to try to raise these issues, that's why I disclosed this, it's just gotta be a lie, because he knew that Wyden was arguing about this at the very highest level, that there was a debate going on inside the Senate Intelligence Committee, and with the administration over what to do about this program. He just didn't like the fact that his side hadn't won that argument, and he decided to win it with a leak. And I think that putting that in that perspective gives a better sense of what he was doing, using his very own words, unless you think that he wasn't telling the truth when he said it was Clapper's statement that pushed him over the edge.
So I won't comment on what he said or on his sequence of events, but I do think you raised some important points. I think it's going forward, especially, but historically, we have had given people the ability to come forward with concerns to various places. They can go to the Inspector General. There are whistleblower protections in the intelligence community. For example, I have a statutory responsibility to investigate complaints, refer them to the appropriate Inspector Generals around the intelligence community. That have to do with civil liberties and privacy. And by statute, people who come to my office or even go to the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, and I know you interviewed David Medin a while ago, who is the chairman of that board, are protected from reprisal. So there are ways that you can go, you can raise concerns, including, through the appropriate channels going directly to the SSCI, to the Senate or to the House. I feel that we could do even more to make sure that those avenues are well understood by the workforce. And so one of the things that we are working on is to make sure that the workforce understands that they have the ability, if they have concerns, to raise them securely and to have those concerns taken seriously. Whenever anyone comes to my office, any employee or contractor comes to my office and raises a concern, we take it very seriously, and we do our best to understand where the concerns are coming from and to address those concerns as best as we can. Even if I've already reviewed the program and feel like the program is appropriately protective, I'm still open to other people coming in and expressing to me their concern. I can change my mind. They can point out something I hadn't focused on, and we are certainly happy to talk to any member of the workforce to figure out what is underlying their concern.
Well, a few of them may even listen to this podcast.
Right.
Alex Joel, thank you so much for coming in. That's been a real pleasure. We went long just because of the topic and how interesting some of your answers were. I will give you an opportunity to plug any future speeches you're going to be giving. Michael, have you got any coming up?
Tomorrow, actually, at the High Trust Conference. This is a consortium of healthcare organizations focused on data security, sort of like an ISAC, but more. It's down in Dallas.
All right. Well, great. Thank you. This has been episode 16 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. I want to thank Jason Weinstein, Michael Vadas, Chris Conte, and Alex Joel. Join us next week for more insights into the latest in technology, security, privacy, and government.